It's Wednesday, January 28th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 134 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 51 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
And my name is Richard Crockett.
We were making fun of Chris earlier because he had a girly name.
Not a girly name.
No, an ambiguous name.
Yeah, is an androgynous name. Yeah.
Like, Chad is definitely a male name.
Precisely. Yeah. Chris, Pat, we don't know.
Dan, I kind of tried to catch Dan because you could do Danielle. But honestly, I've known Danielles in my life, and none of them have ever gone by Dan or Danny.
Yeah, they always go by Danny. Yeah.
I think he's a senator anymore, but how do you think Dick Armey did during high school?
Who?
Dick Armey?
Dick Armey.
Yes, that's his real name.
Oh, yeah, that's his real name.
Nice. The mental image is just disturbing.
I'm not in his jurisdiction, but if he stepped down, that was recent, because I know up until not all that long ago, he was still in the Senate.
He would definitely have a career in the adult film industry if he ever wanted to, I'd have to imagine.
Why would your parents do that to you?
I've never understood that either. See, parents need to think about two things before they name a kid. How is this going to sound on the second grade playground? And how is this going to look on a nameplate of a corporate office?
Yeah,
exactly.
Because parents do stuff that's really cute for a baby. Like, my dad knew someone where their last name was Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And they named their daughter, I'm not making this up, Crystal Shanda Lear.
Oh, man. Ouch.
Epic failure.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not even worried about the second grade of corporate thing. That's just dumb.
Yeah, exactly. But when you name a kid, for heaven's sake, remember that for you, this kid, if you're not thinking right, maybe one step shy of a fashion accessory, but this kid has to suffer with this name on the playground, at college, at the office.
Exactly.
Well, people gave me crap for naming my kid Sky, but I'm not worried about it because it isn't a they're like, that's a girl's name, and it's not. It's not a girl's name. It's like Pat. It can go both ways.
Sure.
Pat goes both ways.
Yeah, the way Dawn and I figure it, Sky's so friggin' big that somebody will make fun of his name once.
The whole, why is his name evading me now? The boy named Sue thing.
Oh, Johnny Cash.
Yeah. I don't know why the heck I couldn't think of his name.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's like that sort of thing. You give him the name Sue to make him tougher.
Yeah, make him tougher and stronger. But I still hate that man. Boy named Sue's great. Did you know who wrote that? It wasn't Johnny Cash.
Wasn't it Ray Stevens or something?
No, it was Silverstein. Shel Silverstein.
Oh, really?
Light in the Attic and all that?
Yep.
Yeah.
I know if you read through Johnny Cash's songs, there's a surprisingly famous list of people that wrote his music. All of his different songs.
Him and Bob Dylan were close friends.
I'm telling you though, man, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Best Johnny Cash performance I ever went to.
I
didn't go to that performance. But the best time I've ever seen his music was sitting there on a cruise ship, came out from dinner, full of meat and wine, go out onto the deck of the ship, and on this huge like Jumbotron type monitor. So I'm out here in the middle of the ocean, sitting on the deck of a ship, and they're playing this huge Johnny Cash concert.
Neat.
It was beautiful.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Wow.
If anybody didn't know it, I am a huge Johnny Cash fan. I love Johnny Cash a lot.
Speaking of which, I am actually, at least unless something falls through, I'm most likely going on the Gamer Adventure Cruise that's coming up at the end of March. So if anyone else listening to the show is also going on that cruise, that I know I'm going to be probably going to be on there. Don from Pulp Gamer is going to be on there. Love to catch up with you, throw down on some board games or something. So if you're going on that cruise, you know, stop by the forums or throw away an email into my email account.
The hell are you talking about? Gamer cruise traveler thing? What?
You haven't heard about the gamer?
I know you're going
thing?
On a cruise, but
the whole thing's gamer themed. Yeah. There's a travel agent by the name of Kim who has taken up creating trips that are specifically meant for gamers. This was the lady that did the LARP cruise last year in October.
This is not another LARP cruise then?
No, this is not a LARP cruise. This one's actually geared towards board games. Hmm. Like they're having a big Catan tournament throughout the cruise and such. But the idea is basically to get a bunch of like-minded geeks together in a vacation spot, and
you're all going to go down in the basement of the ship then, I take it, and play.
That's right, we're gonna hide out in the basement of the ship. my parents have a room down there. We're going to hang out in that particular room of the basement of the ship.
Do you know that the people who made Settlers of Catan had a contest called, I think it was called Cooking with Catan or something like that, where you were supposed to make the Settlers of Catan board game only out of food?
Oh, people, I was expecting, like, what dishes can you make out of wool and gold?
No. They made, like Catan cupcakes, and they had, like, little sheep and blue icing for oceans and stuff. The Catan cookies look good. Somebody did a Catan pizza where it was a hexagonal pizza all put together, and each of the different, like, a forest was broccoli and stuff, but then you had cheese for the rocks. And
we should have a Fear the Boot cooking contest where you have to cook a boot.
You could use a bunch of angel hair pasta for your hair.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, a boot with a wig. Or a merkin, you know, whatever.
Let's talk Fear the Con real quick. I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on this, since we'll probably drop a whole bonus episode on it. But what I actually want to talk about is the things that are going on around Fear the Con. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily at the con, but, and once again, if you haven't signed up for this, fearthecon.com, definitely want to be there, blah, blah, blah. You've heard us say it.
It's the best...
Two days in gaming.
St. Louis gaming, yeah. I guess. But we have a lot of fun.
Two other things that are going on outside of the con that we right now are trying to plan, and we need to get some sense of how many people are going to be involved in this. So stop by the forums and comment on it. But first off, we are looking at on Thursday night, the night before the con, because the con's on March Friday, 5th. Saturday, but on the night of March the 5th, having a wing night for people that are coming into St. Louis, may have arrived that afternoon or evening, get together, have some wings and beers somewhere.
Yep. We did this last year, and it was the social event. It was really
like 75 people or something like that showed up. It was a huge group of people.
And it was great because everybody got that sort of, hey, who are you? Hi, I'm so-and-so. And then, you know, over the course of the night, everyone got through all that, the icebreakers, and then they all loosened up and everybody had a great time. And then when we rolled into the con, all the ice had already been broken.
Yeah.
And it was just like, hey, oh, what's up? Boy, you drank a lot last night. Let's game. Yeah.
The other thing that we're looking at, and by the way, just consider this an F the sleep weekend.
Yeah.
Because the other thing we're looking at is, since Watchmen will come out that weekend, we're looking at a late night showing Friday. So between the two nights of gaming, we close the con down around 11. Mm-hmm. We maybe then go straight out and try to catch a late night showing of Watchmen on that Friday night. So if you're interested in that, let us know. That one, unlike the wing night thing, there's really not a whole lot of planning we can do.
Yeah.
But let's
think of wing night as the Fear the Con social mixer. Think of the Watchmen night as sort of an extracurricular field trip.
You're too wound up to sleep right now anyway, so we'll all go out and catch Watchmen.
Right.
Plus, we don't want Fear the Con to get in the way of your movie-going experiences.
No, we want it to be a part of them.
So, yeah, so we'll head out late that night and catch a Watchmen showing. So if you're interested in those, stop by and let us know. And if you're interested in the con in general, once again, fearthecon.com.
Speaking of movies, Dan, as long as we're talking about this, on the show, well before I got on here, there's a particular game that we've always either used as the whipping boy, the scapegoat, the general thing to hurl abuse at, and that's Riffs. But there is going on now, and a few people, I don't, some people may know this, some people may not, but the rights to a movie based on Riff were purchased quite a while ago.
It's not going to happen.
Anyway, but no, there is a fan-based letter writing initiative going on to get the
Riffs
movie made.
Yeah, that really saved Jericho, jerks.
Yes, by Jeffrey. It's a Bruckheimer deal. I don't know if he gets mail up on his lofty perch, but there is a letter writing campaign going on here to have fans push to get a Riffs movie made. How they would ever actually accomplish this, because it would have to be a movie about everything, I'm not sure, but we could see Glitter Boys on the big screen.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. Here's why. It's not that I'm against it or that I'm panning Riffs here, but
I am.
Let's just call it for what it is. If you look at the population, the movie-going population of the U.S., Riffs has a pretty small following. Okay, Riffs is nowhere near Star Wars. I don't think a big-budget movie is going to happen, and if it does, it's going to be really hard to make a success. I may eat those words, but if you look at how hard it's been to get good movies made about major superheroes that are household names within the U.S., I mean, it's an endless ongoing struggle. Look at how long it took to get a Transformers movie made.
Are you ripping on the Punisher?
Look at how long it took to get, all three movies of that were all bombs. Look at how popular Dungeons & Dragons is.
Yeah.
Millions of people play it, and they could barely eke out two awful.
Yeah, one
movie.
Mediocre and one awful.
Well, yeah, the
movie.
Second one was kind of fun. I wouldn't call it good,
so,
but it was fun.
It's not going to, you know, and yeah. I'm sorry to say it. I wish it would happen. I wish more RPG movies would get made. I'm not saying this because I'm panning Risk or I'm panning Risk fans, but just because I think the realistic facts of the numbers are there just aren't enough consumers out there. I mean, they're still struggling to make a World of Warcraft movie, and World of Warcraft's a hell of a lot bigger than Rifts is.
Yeah. Did you know that Blizzard threw out Uwe Boll out of their offices?
Yeah, I did hear that, and that's fantastic.
He scheduled a meeting with them. He went to their office, and they're like, okay, what do you got? We know what you want, but what do you got? And he's like, I want to make a movie out of World of Warcraft. And they said, we will never allow you to make a movie on any of our IPs.
And even if that's an urban legend.
And then he fought them in a boxing ring.
Yeah.
Even if that's an urban legend, I will it to be true because
it's
really so beautiful.
Did happen. Yeah.
Well, it's true because we just said it. We just said it was true.
So now this is the internet. Right. Now it's true.
If you live in the Ontario, Canada area, or you're looking to go up that way, there is a con that's occurring in Guelph, Ontario. It's spelled G-U-E-L-P-H. It's pronounced Guelph.
Looks like Griff. Gwyff?
No. That's too. The con is called GriffCon.
Oh, is it?
So
yes.
We'll put the link to this in the show notes. If you're going to be up in that area, stop by GriffCon at GRYPHCON.org. GriffCon.org.
Yes.
And we'll link that in
neighbors.
The show notes. So stop by and show some love, show some support for the gaming community.
That's
going to
be
area.
Friday, March 27th to Sunday, March 29th.
So it will not interfere with your Fear the Con attendance. All right, Chris, what's your shout out?
I just have to do a quick shout out to my daughter, Bailey, who turned 13 on today as we record it. So she will already be 13 by the time the episode drops, but that's all right.
Yes. And I want to real quick thank Clayne Kaluna and both Kim and Chris Engler. They really hopped onto the Pirates of the Cursed Sea thing that we talked about, and they were huge players back when it was a supported game. They had tons of this Pirates of the Cursed Sea stuff, unpunched cards sitting around gathering dust, heard that we were into it, and then they both sent us tons of unpunched cards, and we will be giving out these cards at Fear the Con.
Yes.
We will actually, what I'm planning on doing is I am going to set up a table and I'm going to put together you put together like 40 points worth of ships unpunched in little stacks. And anyone who wants to can go up to the table with a stack of 40 ships, grab a stack off and play anyone else. And when you're done playing the game, you can keep your ships.
Nice.
Yep.
Very nice.
All right, Chris. You had some kind of a banter topic for us to talk about.
Yeah, I was going to, you know, last week, well, we were recording last week's episode and you guys were kind of droning on and on. I was going through some old Dragon magazines. Did you guys actually get Dragon magazine?
Yes.
Two of you? Okay, so then you're going to know what I'm talking about.
I did
about.
Not.
All right, that's okay.
I know what Dragon and Dungeon is, but...
Well, okay, let me rephrase it that way. My parents would not allow me to have a subscription, but I knew enough people that did that I consumed the magazine.
Under your bed or something? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My parents would allow me to get a subscription, and I didn't want one.
Chat at feartheboot.com.
Why would I? I didn't play D&D.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's true. At the time, we were playing Star Trek and Shadowrun. We weren't playing D&D.
And
actually, it's surprising.
The old issues, I'm talking pre-3E issues. The really old ones, they had more than just D&D stuff in there. Granted, not very much, but they did.
No, that's true. And I tell you, that is kind of strange. As a group of gamers, it is interesting because not only was our first game not D&D, but we didn't pick up D&D until several years into our gaming lives, which I know is kind of interesting. So many people tend to start with that or even not start with it. It's one of their really early games, and we actually played a ton of games before we got to D&D. But all right, go on,
no,
Chris.
Well,
but
looking through these, I mean, obviously, you know, you got your assortment of articles. But for me, really, one of the coolest parts of the magazine ever was the gamer's guide they used to put in the back. And that was basically all your small-time ancillary gaming operations who couldn't afford a full-page ad. But they would put like these little, you know, either business card size ad or these really small ones in there for whatever it was that they were selling. You know, you have either it's your various mail order shops, you know, Wargames West is a good example. They were a mail order business that had, you know, just a ton of gaming stuff. But they only ever put the small little tiny ads in there. But you get these guys who had, I actually ordered this. I was looking through here and I found one that I had ordered. Sort of a company called, and I'm sure they do not exist anymore, but They're called Pioneer Dungeons. And these guys were like the predecessors to your Dwarven Forge of today. And they basically had your plaster mold dungeon walls. And you order a certain kit, or you'd have to actually mail out to get a catalog, because you couldn't. There was no internet to get onto. And you'd get back, and you'd go through this catalog, which was, you know, hand-stapled, you know, a bunch of 8.5 by 11 sheets, and you just order these little things, you know, these little wall sets, or these little floor sets, or whatever, room sets, or you've got the, you know, the artists who would try and who'd be soliciting to draw your character, that kind of thing, you know. And you don't really see that kind of stuff anymore. I mean, obviously, you know, because there's not very many gaming magazines anymore, but most of that kind of stuff now, it just all exists online. But it's just kind of a neat thing to go through and look and see all these various stores or whatnot.
The great thing about the internet is that having such a, I don't know, a broad market here, it allows a lot of people to get involved. But the bad part is that you can't always...
The bad part is that it allows a lot of people to get involved?
Yes, but that's a different discussion. But a lot of times it's hard to find people. I mean, it used to be, and back in that day, I know exactly what Chris is talking about, that if you wanted an artist or you drop some modest amount of money to get your character drawn, that you could go to this guy and get it done, and you knew where to find this person, whereas now... It's a really tough thing to find these people. I mean, I remember mentioning on the show about a year ago.
Wait. Are you saying that it's tough to find artists to draw your character, or tough to find the specific person you're talking about?
I mean,
if you want to find someone to draw your character, you just type in freelance artist RPG character in Google, and then you find out 10,000 sites.
That's the problem, though. You find 10,000 sites.
With things like that used to exist in Dragon Magazine, you've got guys who are serious about this because, A, they're investing the money to place an ad in this magazine, so they're already kind of backing up their own credibility to get the job done, whereas opposed to now, when you can just Google it, you're not necessarily, you know, you're going to get a lot of that, you know, flotsam out there that, you know, put something up, but they may not finish the job.
And a lot of the sites, it maybe they put it up 4 years ago, and they actually don't do anything anymore. They never check the site. There's one guy that I emailed repeatedly. He never got back to me. There might be they put up a site, and maybe they actually are good and complete it, but you can't get them to do anything because they are so backed up. And it was neat having that kind of little shop where it took some kind of an entry fee to get in. But once you got in, like you said, Chris, you knew they were serious about it. And I'm not saying this was 100% success rate, but you had at least some idea that, hey, here's the one place to go within a nice small shop to find people who are actually going to do this. But, you know, I wonder if this maybe draws us into the broader discussion of how any hobby or subculture changes as it gets bigger and more diverse. I mean, I can remember we were talking about, like within MMOs, how there was a completely different culture to MMOs back when it was like UO and EQ and that's all there was. And then suddenly it got really broad and it's never been the same since.
Yeah.
I've seen the same thing in podcasts. I mean, I used to talk endlessly about how podcasters are the coolest people on the face of the earth. For a long time, that was true. And then podcasting got a lot more diverse and a lot more people got in here and that old culture disappeared. And I wonder if that's the larger issue here, is that when any hobby gets too big or too diverse or too many people get into it, you never can get back that original golden age.
Or maybe nostalgia gives you rose-colored glasses.
Both are probably true.
Yeah, I think that's a little bit of both in there. But it would be nice if, you know, and I guess filters for that kind of stuff, because in a certain sense, that's really what, you know, this little gamer's guide in Dragon Magazine was. It was a filter to, you know, get rid of all the ones who weren't serious about it, you know, because of price. Does such a thing like that exist today where you can, you know, is there essentially that reliable portal that you can go through? You know, I don't know if there is or not. As long as we're going down a little bit of a nostalgia trail, and this, I guess, is just nostalgia for me in a certain sense, but it still kind of rings true today, I think, for those younger gamers.
It's like those gamers under 50.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Yeah, those who don't have gray hair. But it used to be, at least for me, at least in high school and college, basically until I got married, gaming on holidays was probably the best time to do that because, A, you're off from school, B, you know all your friends are going to be home, and three, with the exception of a couple of hours that you have to spend with family, you know, doing that required family thing, you could go off and go do whatever you want. You know, Thanksgivings were great for me because all my gaming buddies were basically either right on my road or not very far away and they can be here in a couple of minutes. So we'd do the whole Thanksgiving thing and then we'd all go and get together and game. You know, and that was true basically for almost any holiday, including especially over like Christmas break. But, you know, as you obviously as you get older, you can't do that. And suddenly holidays become the absolute worst time to game. And you're clearly flat out as far as gaming goes. You just there's no way you can get out of it.
Chris, I know exactly what you were talking about. Growing up, neither me nor my group of friends were all that close to our families. I said we disliked our families or whatever, but there was enough tension there that we were all kind of, you know, the black sheep a little bit on the outside things that were going on. And I can remember a holiday, it was a major holiday. I don't remember if it was Thanksgiving or Christmas. I want to say it might have even been Christmas, where instead of being with our families, everyone was over at my place and we were gaming Battletech in the basement. And
I don't remember a Christmas like that. I don't think my parents would have cut me loose.
I think what changed.
Thanksgiving, maybe?
It may have been. All I remember is that, not that this is going to mean a whole lot to people listening to the podcast, but there was a particular ceremony we called Texas Paint and Cuss, because Tex was a really good model painter. Maybe still is. I haven't seen anything out of him lately. But at least back in the day, he was probably one of the best model painters that I have ever seen. But there was a process by which this occurred called Texas Paint and Cuss, which involved a gratuitous amount of obscenity and pseudo violence, which maybe someday I'll get him on the air and he can explain to you how Texas Paint and Cuss would work. But I remember that what we were doing is we were reenacting Texas Paint and Cuss in front of my extended family. I suppose what has changed since then is that we have gone from being the black sheep of the family to being the family. Now, instead of being the son, I'm the husband. Mm-hmm. And Chad, in your case, and Chris's case, and Pat's case, you're not just the husband, you're the father.
Yes.
And so I realize we're kind of in that transition, at least the three of us, meaning me and Chad and Pat, being a little bit younger, may still be in that transition period where we're going from established family traditions to building our own traditions. But nonetheless, we're getting to the point where we're establishing our own traditions.
I think that's my big problem with holidays is that it isn't that. It isn't I wish it was establishing your own traditions. I wish, like, Christmas is a perfect example. Christmas, I have to go around to like three or four different places. Christmas does not like, I mean, you could say, oh, Christmas starts in October and all that, but I mean, the actual like doing the holiday going around, it's not one day. It's not 2 days. It's not Christmas, even Christmas. It is a week long. It is 7 solid days of different family members doing different stuff. All of it Christmas for me. And it sucks. And it's because Christmas, it isn't building your own tradition. I looked at Dawn one day and I'm like, can't we just have Christmas to ourselves? Chris, why can't Christmas be you, me, and Sky get up and we have a nice breakfast and we throw him at some presents and he goes crazy and then we just hang out and spend the day together?
There, not to put on the old man hat, but essentially that will eventually
happen. You're going to pull on the old man hat.
I don't want to get too far away from gaming, but I know, Chad, I know exactly what you're talking about because we did the exact same thing. But then there came that one year where basically we did the family thing, and two of the three kids had ear infections and were completely miserable and whining the entire time. And we and like everybody from my family, and I come from a family of 7, so we have, you know, all siblings are there plus spouses plus their own kids, and it took forever to do anything. And we both, Jewel and I, realized this is ridiculous, and we're not going to do this anymore, at least in this fashion. And so you eventually reach that breaking point where you just decide to break and then set those traditions. But to swing this back around, for some reason, and again, maybe this is also just, you know, the looking back to fondness of youth, but gaming on holidays like that to me always seemed to be some of my, I don't know, most enjoyable times. I don't know if it was because we had more hours to do it in, if you were still kind of basking in a little bit of holiday glow, you know, or you're happy at your new presents or full of turkey or whatever. But those times always seem to be much more enjoyable to me. Those sessions around the table always seem to be much more enjoyable, you know. And so it's not that the other ones weren't, but there was just that little something extra that was there.
Another thing I'm thinking of is like, it's Memorial Day, let's game because the family's gone to the lake, versus it's Memorial Day, I can't game because I have to take the family to the lake.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That's exactly what it is.
Along those lines, though, I'm also thinking about how, for example, it used to be Friday nights may not be the best night to game because we might all be going out. Now Friday nights are the best night to game because none of us are going out.
Yeah.
It, you know, and it, you know, that kind of that transition kind of really brings home the realization that, A, gosh, I really enjoy gaming and I miss it because I can't do it on holidays anymore, and reminds you of the importance of trying to maintain as regular a schedule as possible. You know, and you have to work that extra hard or take that extra step to really make sure that, A, you know, that your days are locked down and that you're all going to be there. You know,
are you talking about gaming or bowel movements?
I'm talking about both, actually, if you want to get down into it. I mean,
no, we do not want to get down into it.
Hey, I mean,
I remember when we were teenagers, though, because Chris was talking about the importance of schedule. And I think that that's really important when you're over the age of like 20 or 25 with your gaming group, is to get a regular schedule once a week, once every 2 weeks, once a month, what, you know, whatever your thing is, and to be very consistent about it. Because I remember when we were teenagers, God, we had all the time in the world. Half of us didn't have jobs. Those of us that did only worked like 10 hours a week. We're all lazy bums. Did we even have a regular schedule game? I mean, I just remember we played.
No, it was just all the time. Yeah.
What are you doing tonight? Nothing. All right, let's play. Okay.
Let's game. Start calling people. This is before email. You know? Start making phone calls. And then we just get together.
So the lesson out of this is be consistent.
That's right.
And if you're in that stage where you're gaming on holidays, enjoy it while you can.
I think the lesson out of this is that I find it's actually easier to game now that I'm older, because I can actually have a set schedule instead of just this random exuberance of youth of just doing anything at any time and doing gaming all the time. I look back on that with fond memories, but man, I don't want to go back to that. That's just not fun to me. I mean, I have other interests now.
I would, but you know, job and kids and stuff just don't make that possible.
I can see where you're coming from, Chad, but you know, in a practical sense for me, I kind of like having that schedule because in a certain sense it does set deadlines on me when it comes to what I want to work on, you know, making notes, you know, for the next session instead of winging it all the time, because I'm not like you where I can do that and be happy with it. I like to have the notes, and having that schedule forces me to do that now, which I prefer.
Well, and it's also a matter, I have a broad range of interests now. I think I have a broader and more demanding palette of interests than I did when I was a teenager, when I would just do any old thing, no matter how crappy it was.
Yes.
And now I have to make time for that. And I can, when I make time for that, I focus all of my attention on one thing, be it a role-playing game or be it anything else.
You know, last episode, we gave Chris a little bit of GMing help. And this episode, we're going to give Chad a little bit of GMing help.
I need none. I am perfect.
Because Chad, a couple episodes ago, was saying that one of the things that he struggles with as a GM is trying to make clear. Let's say you're running a game.
Sure.
And you have this huge amount of plot, all these things that are going on in the background, all these political maneuverings and events that are going on in the background that the players are not immediately aware of. But you need to make them aware of these things so they can appreciate the world they're playing within.
But I don't want to wheel up the plot wagon and dump it all right out in front of them with them just waiting expectantly. I don't want to spoon feed it. And I don't want to drive railroad tracks and railroad them around and have them led around by an all-powerful NPC pointing out the plot along the way. I want them to figure it out.
You're looking for something a bit more to be perceived as a bit more organic in a certain sense. Yeah.
Let the players figure it out, or at least trickle it to them in a slow, consistent sort of way.
Build some tension, build some drama.
It's like if you get into fiction writing, it's what they say, show me, don't tell me, that kind of thing. How do you get it out to them in a way that feels natural? And let's start off some ways that don't work. And Chad, you mentioned some of them. I think the worst one is the all-powerful NPC.
Yeah.
That you have an NPC.
The Gandalf.
Who knows what's going on, but won't tell you because you're not ready yet.
Yeah.
It's condescending.
He's so damn mysterious.
Yeah, it's condescending. It's annoying. It's patronizing. Mm-hmm. Ditch that whole concept. If you've got an NPC who's running the game, guess what? You don't need PCs because the NPCs already knows it all and it's taking care of it all. So
I
have been in many games. Now, I'm not saying I have a problem with an NPC that knows things the players don't or can do things the players don't. That's fine. But just when you have the NPC the Game Master's just totally getting off on, ditch that character and move on.
Or, you know, or if you feel that you have to do that, you got to put some limits on that guy then in a certain sense. Whether it's, you know, if he knows so much, then he has to suffer in other ways. He has to be either, you know, maybe he's physically weak, so he can't contribute when it comes to combat. Or maybe he, you know, I don't know, maybe he only can show up every once in a while and he's not there at certain critical times. And so the players do have to do something, you know, on their own. But, I mean, if you can put limitations on him, if you feel compelled to have that NPC, you know, you should. You should put some restrictions on him.
Chad, the other thing you mentioned was wheeling up the plot wagon.
Yeah.
And I think there is some danger in explaining too much through narrative or exposition.
This was something, we've mentioned this on the show before, I think, where this is something that Dave used to describe with a group that he had before any of us were involved with him, where he had a group that were kind of more traditional, just straightforward ROLL players. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whoever the Game Master was would construct a big, deep, you know, organic plot with NPCs and characters and stuff. And they would kind of be interacting with the story. And then they'd be like, no, we just want to get on to the adventure, man. Not necessarily the killing, but just the they wanted to buckle their swashes. And they're just like, yeah, just roll the plot wagon on up and tell us what happens. You know, tell us what's going on. We don't care.
That can be very deflating for a GM, I think.
Oh, my God. That would kill me.
It's deflating for a GM because it gives you the sense your characters, or rather your players, mm-hmm. don't really care what's going on. Yeah. But I think in most groups...
Can you imagine if in Lord of the Rings, Frodo just didn't give two flips why he had to throw the ring in the volcano?
Yeah.
And just was just doing
it? Gandalf starts explaining, like, stuff it. Where's the volcano?
Yeah.
It'd be a much shorter and more boring story, but yeah. I think it's also can be deflating for most groups of players because there's no sense of accomplishment. You don't have a sense that you learned anything or uncovered anything. Mm-hmm. It was just handed to you very
well. It for those kinds of people, I think that the win of the game, so to speak, what they get out of it is the new pair of magic boots and the fact that did you see how we owned that well giant, he was so deep, and you know, that sort of thing. It's like the win comes from something else. And you know, if they're down with that and the Game Master's down with that, more power to them. It's kind of a shallow
at least for most of the groups I've been in, though,
there's a lot of people out there who game like that, though.
Yeah, and actually I want to do a whole episode on that style of gaming, not bashing it, but just talking about it.
Wrong-headed gaming,
sure, but
you know,
chat at feartheboot.com.
I think go ahead.
No, go ahead, Chris.
Well, I was gonna say,
give you this one.
Well, all right. I think maybe part of the problem for that, in the sense that I don't want to pull up the plot train, you know, maybe could possibly stem from the fact that the Game Master doesn't want to deal with a derailment of their train. They think they've got their train hidden pretty well. So they'll throw these things out there and making it the only option for the characters to choose. So they'll do that, you know, thus avoiding the possibility that they might, you know, totally go off the rails and do something that he's not prepared for. So, you know, well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, that actually makes me think of looking at this from another angle. Maybe the players are looking at you going, just roll up the plot wagon and dump it out in front of us. Maybe they're saying that not because they're totally disinterested in your plots, but maybe your plot is really, really bad.
Yeah.
And maybe not that plot's bad, but you're a notoriously bad GM. And they're just like, okay, get on to it. Get on with it, man. Get on with it.
Maybe, rolling dice at Oris is far more interesting than your story.
Maybe,
so.
Maybe really your story. Yeah. Maybe your story is like the opening of Star Wars, you know, where they have that text scroll, only instead of being kind of to the point and interesting, it just keeps scrolling. And scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, and they're like, come on.
You know, I think that, you know, one simple way for me that kind of jumps to mind to kind of avoid that problem is present them with, you know, several possible plots. You know, there's if you're in fantasy, well, then it's your town crier who's going around and giving a variety of things to talk about. Or you're overhearing all kinds of bits of conversation if you're in the tavern. If you're doing your cyberpunk thing, then it's, you know, your scream sheets, like they used to have in Shadowrun, and you have handouts that are nothing but just various news stories. And you're not revealing at all which one matters. And maybe behind the scenes, you've somehow, as a game master, got these things all connected to your main plot. So regardless of what path you take, you're still going to lead there. But you've more effectively hidden the train in this particular case.
GM handouts. There is a whole show topic.
Here's something, though, that Chris brought up that is interesting to me. And that I said on a previous show, and kind of where the show has come from, is that I have a lot of problem with my reveals. Either I am afraid I reveal too much, or I don't. Actually, my big problem is I don't reveal enough. I want the players to be more engaged in my plot than I should probably realistically expect from them.
Well, it may not be an issue of engage, but sometimes you presume that, and I say you, but this is that undefined you, one presumes that the players are inside your head.
Yeah.
Yes.
There are things that make perfect sense to you because it's the way you think, it's your story, whatever the issue is.
I think I have a big problem with that.
And as a result, the players just are not getting something that is in your head. But let's move on from the bad things to the way this ought to be done. What I would say is you need to watch your players, because if you have this big, complex situation and they understand nothing, one of two things is going to happen. They're either going to be lost and have no idea what they're doing and no idea what's going on and never appreciate the story you're telling, because as far as they're concerned, the dragon stole a maiden, and the fact that, oh, the dragon's actually a moniker for a wizard who thinks this and the maiden did that, they'll never get that. Or they're just going to get frustrated.
Yeah.
And so I would say that one thing you got to watch is what is going on. Now, here's the first tip I would give for actually revealing little bits of plot. If you keep clues streaming out that the players have some opportunity to roll on, for example,
like roll dice on, or
yes, roll dice
or
on,
or activate on,
for example, you happen to be in a room, and maybe in the room is going to be some, like a letter from one party to another that would kind of tell you a little bit about the plot. And if they roll dice for their search roll and they don't quite make it, and they made it, and here it is. Because you know what? If they don't make it and they don't find that note, then they're going to be that much more lost about what's going on. So sometimes you as a GM have to give them a little bit. I'm not saying back up the plot wagon or condescend to them.
You're talking about cheating.
Yeah, but sometimes you've got to cheat just a little bit, because if they're not getting the story or understanding what's going on.
But how would you answer all the people? And I totally agree with you, by the way. Because I believe that the GM should have a set of tools that he could use at will within his game. But how would you answer the people who would say, who would counter that and say, well, that is GM cheating?
Depends on,
would say, well, there is a certain reality within the game that is consistent to both the players and the GM no matter what, and the GM just broke that reality, so now we can't determine what is real and what isn't within the context of rules.
You know, and
well,
I would...
it's the same thing. I mean, let's go back to Lord of the Rings. Or at least the movie anyway, seeing as how I have not read the books. They're standing outside Moria, and they can't figure out how to get in. Well, if they all just decide to give up, well, then I guess the adventure's over, then, isn't it? Something has got to happen to allow things to move forward. And if it means that you have to cheat just this one time to move them forward, if they're not, everything can be completely and utterly open-ended. Sometimes you do have to go in a straight line. You just do. And if you're in that kind of situation and they can't move forward, you have to help them.
Well, here's the thing that I would say.
Well, and I to kind of further back up Chris, I would say that using his Mines of Moria example, fudging it so that they can get through the secret door into the Mines of Moria, whereas the alternative would be to backtrack and walk around the mountains where nothing happens. Sure, you know, you don't want to cheat, and you're not going to do that, and they're going to walk around the mountain. Going around the mountain, boring. Going through the Mines of Moria, exciting.
Yeah.
What do you want in your game?
Well,
boring or exciting?
As a big proponent of fairness and balance, the thing that I would say is the overriding concern that I have in every single game when I sit down to run it or play it, the objective here, the way in which everybody wins, is by having fun. Now, I'm a big proponent of fairness and balance and give the players what they get and don't give them what they don't get, until you hit that point where now it's degrading people's fun.
Yeah.
They're getting frustrated. They're getting confused. They're getting angry. At this point now, it is better to fudge things a little bit mm-hmm. and sacrifice that virtue of fairness than to sacrifice the virtue of entertainment, because that's the point of a game. And so
what, I can just imagine people railing at this right now. Well, there is a certain, and I don't want to sound like I support this, because I actually don't, but there is a certain kind of gamer out there who that's abhorrent to them. Well, the rules are the rules, and they apply to the game master and the player.
Well, it may not even be that. Now, that's one possibility, yeah. But another possibility is there's a lot of people out there that like challenge gaming.
Right.
Where the idea is that this is hard.
When your character dies, he's dead, you roll another right. one, and it's hard, and it's difficult.
And there's puzzles that the GM's not going to give you any help right. on. And the point of it is to challenge, and I understand that. But you know what? That's a completely different style of gaming yeah. than what is... Because we're presumably talking about narrative or story-driven gaming here.
Yeah, that's almost a whole show is, I like that concept, challenge gaming, where it's not just about, well, you're fighting monsters that are more difficult than you should be able to take. I mean, that might be a part of it, but is puzzles with no clues, plots that are thick that you have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, and if you can miss die this, at any turn, you're done. You didn't get it.
Yeah. It, yeah, exactly. It's like, there's the main plot. You have one chance to do X, and you just hesitate. But I think that would actually be an interesting
There's a
game.
Presumption here when you say, I need help figuring out how to give these reveals. The presumption is that you want to give the reveals.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you that's know, not and, the and, same challenge. And this goes back to, Dan, one of your original points about assuming the players are inside your head, and which actually, for some reason, kind of almost ties back into the banter topic, which is bizarre. But using a real-world example, when we go and produce a promotional spot for our station, we have to take a close look at it from a number of angles to make sure that, A, that we're not making fun in any certain way, shape, or form of our anchors, that we're portraying them in a positive light, that anything that we say, you know, for the most part, could not be misconstrued or misinterpreted by your average viewer. And we have to look at it from that average viewer's standpoint. And
yeah, because your anchors are the face.
The anchors are the face, and plus we work at the station, so we know what we're doing when we're putting this stuff together, and we go into it with a certain set of assumptions. And you have to go through that whole kind of checks and balances process to see, oh, wait a second, you know what? We know what it meant when we put this word on there, but nobody's going to understand really what that means. We need to actually expand it to really say this, or we need to maybe get a shot that looks and portrays this particular image. And it really is the same way with your gaming. You're right. Nobody knows the campaign better than the GM, which is the way it should be. But yet on the other side, you've got five or six other people who only have real contact with your campaign once a week, once every two yeah. weeks. They're not going to remember all these details. So everything that you have, you've got to look through it in their eyes and their ears and look at what you're describing. Does this yeah. make sense to someone who did not write this? Are they going to understand? Can they visualize what you're trying to portray? And then can they pick up then on the visual clues? So perhaps your reveals are all written in there, but if you're not describing them correctly, they're not going to pick them up at all.
Now, Chris, what about like in your example with the anchor not wanting to release something that makes fun of them? It's your responsibility not to make fun of them. You can't, or you know, this is just the example. You can't say something and then the listening public or the viewing public comes back to you and says, hey, you made fun of them. You might want to pull that. And you pull it. That's not how it works. You put something out there that embarrasses the anchor, and then it's egg on your face and on the anchor's face and on the station's face, and everyone pays for it. Obviously, that's not the case with a game. With a game, it's like a group of friends sitting around, and the friends like each other and that sort of thing. So in a role-playing game context, how incumbent is it upon the players to tell the GM straight up, I'm not understanding what you're trying
I
to
think
tell
very,
me.
Very, and oh, that's very. one of the things I've seen in games even recently where the plot's highly obfuscated and the players end up getting frustrated because they feel that they're just getting blocked at every turn, or they don't get what's going on, or they're completely lost, or the whatever.
You know, go ahead.
Rather than telling the GM, they just get mad. And now the GM, I'd say it's incumbent upon you to not end up there in the first place.
Sure.
But if you end up there,
well, we're all human.
Yeah, then it's absolutely incumbent upon the players to say something about it. Now, something I
Well, I was going to say, I think that the best way of going about it is not necessarily while the GM's going through his thing and you say, wait a minute, what the f*** are you talking about here? But it's the post game.
The post game and the pre game as well.
Yeah.
When you sit down at that next session, that following week or whatever, it's very important that somebody take the lead at the mm-hmm. table and say, okay, so what happened last week? What were we doing?
Yeah. You know,
and then let the GM start the recap and let the players pitch in for what they remembered and jog everybody's memory and take that 5 minutes to get everybody kind of. Basically, it's you're previously on 24 and you recap everything. So everyone knows what's going on and then you proceed forward.
I've seen GMs do this and it might be a touch of laziness or a touch of brilliance, probably both. When they don't do a recap, but they say, okay, guys, what happened last week? And you get the players to start talking about it and then that jogs their memory. You can also take a sounding from that. What did they catch? What didn't they catch? What was so understated that they don't remember it that you need to bring back this week? I think that that is a very, and I know, Dan, you do this, and I think that that is a very effective tool that game masters can use instead of doing the, I mean, you could do, it's like, what do you guys remember? Blah, 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 A, B, and C. And it's like, huh, they didn't remember one. They did remember A. They didn't remember two, but they did get three. So, all right. This is what happened, and then you do the recap kind of based on that. And I think that's highly effective.
Oh, yeah. There's a tremendous amount that can be learned, A, just not only about what they perceived, but also learned a lot about your particular style of running a game and how you maybe present things. It's giving you mm-hmm. notes for the future of like, man, I better change the way I approach this when it happens again.
Yeah.
So let's get back to the reveal techniques. The first one we gave was fudging dice rolls, that if they're rolling a notice check or you're rolling intellect to see if they figure something out, maybe fudge it a little bit in their favor to let them see something.
You have to be careful with that. There's this trope in gaming of if I walk into a room and I have to make a spot check and it's not for a trap, but for something that's important to the plot, no matter what I roll, I will always succeed at it because the GM requires me to notice that to advance his plot. And I don't have a problem with that. It's just that if it gets overused, well, it's cheesy.
The thing that I would respond to with that is I would say that you ought to plan your reveals the same way you plan every other plot point. That we've talked about how in games, to keep people off the railroad, that if there's a major thing they need to encounter, an event you've written, that you ought to write so it can happen in town A or town B in case right. they leave town A. I would say do the exact mm-hmm. same thing with your reveals, that if you have a reveal, say, look, they need to figure this out. They need to expose to this. And here's two or three ways it might happen.
Yeah.
So if they walk into a room and fail spot check, that's fine. But here's a crazy drunk in the next town
yeah.
who might happen to mumble the same thing.
And don't get overexcited about it either. I know that's one of my problems as a GM is that I really want him to catch this plot hook. I really want him to catch this plot hook. And, you know, I keep kind of revolving the game around it till they get it. Cut them loose. Let them go away from the plot. You know, they failed the roll, didn't quite work out. They didn't catch it. They didn't understand it. Let them carry on. Let them pursue some of their own stuff for a little bit. Not games right. and games and games. And then introduce it. In a different, I think that's important too, is different way. So you walk into a dark room, you want them to find the letter under the book, and they fail the spot check. Okay, 3 hours later, you're still playing the same game. Okay, you enter a different room. You have to find the letter under the book. And then, yeah, change it up a little bit. Otherwise, your players are smart. They start seeing patterns.
The other type of reveal you can do is reveal more than what you want. Build that sense of an organic world and throw a number of things out there that may indeed lead all to the same path, but it gives that sense that there's more going on here than just that one thing that they must do. You know, oh, we can go, oh, listen, they were talking about this. Let's go investigate that a little bit. Well, okay, yeah, we'll go this way, but yet it still leads around to where you want them to go.
Something else I'd say is get over yourself and stop being so damned mysterious. That one NPC who knows it all but won't yeah. say anything but riddles. Okay, if your players are getting lost and frustrated, have the guy just put up and explain something.
Yeah.
Tell what's going on. other possibilities is...
And then have him shot right away after he says
that. Well, I think an interesting test you can do is that if you're doing that or something like that to build up the tension and the drama and the mystery, and you need to empathize with your players. If they don't care, you're doing it wrong. Just do the reveal and move on.
Exactly. Something else I'd say is, you know what, it may be a little cliche, but sometimes you can overhear the plan straight from the bad guy. The players get captured and overhear something or see something. They intercept a letter between two bad guys. It's a little cliche. Try to be creative with it. But nonetheless, the bad guys themselves, if they're doing a plan that has any degree of complexity, this takes communication and organization. And there are many different ways in which the players could become privy to that communication, which might start telling them little bits and pieces about what's going on inside that world of plot and evil that's occurring behind the scenes. I think we're going to go ahead and wrap it up here. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Later days.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.